nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so now let's come back to the Maxwell's equation. As I said, I'd like to briefly recapitulate them with you because they are very important. It's amazing how these four equations, how rich physics phenomena they actually describe. Just simple four equations. All right, so the first one is tells us that the divergence of electric flux density, D is also called the displacement current, and I'm more used to call it the displacement current or electric flux density, it's the same. The divergence of D is equal to the charge density. It's basically represent the Coulomb's law, and we will see that it's equivalent to the Coulomb's law. And the divergence of B, where B is the magnetic flux density, or sometimes also called magnetic induction, is equal to zero, and that simply indicates that there are no magnetic charges, although some people still trying to find out such things, but I don't believe there is any evidence for that. So there are no magnetic charges, and therefore the divergence of B is equal to zero. This is a very, very important equation which describes actually the dynamics, the possibility of existence of electromagnetic waves, and that's what enables the most exciting applications we have. So this is basically the Faraday's law, which tells us that the circle of the electrical field is equal to the derivative of the magnetic induction with the opposite sign. And finally, the Ampere's law, which tells us that the circle of H, where H is the magnetic field, is given by the sum of the two terms, the current density J and the derivative of the displacement current D. So perhaps I should say a couple of words to confuse you that in reality, when you go from microscopic equations to macroscopic one, when you average over a particular size, so E, what we call E, it's the true electrical field which you obtain after the averaging. But E, H, and B, they are mixed with each other. They are actually interchanged. Because when you average the magnetic field, somehow, I don't know, it happened historically, you started to call it B. So B is actually the true magnetic field averaged over some macroscopic size. And H is not really the one which you measure. H is kind of derivative from B. Well, it probably confuses you, but that's the reality. It happened historically. So the right way would be B should be called H and H should be called B. So, but that's the way it happened because the average field E is E and D is something what follows from E. But with BH, the situation is reversed. Well, anyway, so let's take it as it is. It doesn't matter how you call things, but this confusion has some historical roots. And it's too late to change history, and probably doesn't make sense. All right. What is really important here is so-called constitutive relations, which describe how this D and B depends on E and H. So the thing here to appreciate when you apply a field to a material, that materials get polarized. You basically, like it's shown here, you have the displacement of charges. Charges are redistributed and you induce polarization. And what we mean by the displacement current D or the electric flux density is the electrical field plus the polarization. There is also this dielectric constant of vacuum. I personally don't like this SI units. I don't like this epsilon naught, but I mean, that's the way we are taught and we're gonna stay with this system of units. All theorists, actually all books in theoretical physics, and that's what my training in is, they use ESU units, which to me has by far more sense. But, I mean, all engineers use these units and we're going to follow that. There are also some advantages in these units too, although I never appreciated the electric constant of vacuum. But anyway, so in these units, which we're going to stay with, epsilon is the electric constant of vacuum, which is equal to this number. And epsilon is material, the electric constant, which is really, really important thing. So you can write the displacement current in this way, epsilon times E. The important thing here that polarization, in most cases we assume, and within this course we always will assume, that it's linearly depends on the field. The more field you apply, the stronger you polarize your object. But it's not always the case. There is a separate course which I teach, actually, nonlinear optics. When you apply really big field, then the response is not linearly proportional to the field. It could depend on the field in nonlinear fashion, and that actually resulted in an entirely new field, nonlinear optics, that what enables lasers, things like this, because polarization is not, thanks God, always proportional to the electrical field. But in most cases it is, if field is low, and then you actually can write it in this way. The same way we introduce this magnetic flux intensity, not exactly the same, you pay attention. Here you, we don't have here epsilon naught, here you have mu naught. So it's slightly, there's some asymmetry in the way we introduce the magnetic flux density. In most, for the most part of this course, but not for all the course, we will assume that there is no magnetism in materials, and which means that actually this M magnetization or magnetic polarization vector is equal to zero. So then B is simply equal mu naught H. That will be for the true for the most of the course except metamaterials. In metamaterials, we actually show how you can create magnetism at optical frequency, and this is the way to get refractive index negative. Well, anyway, so for now we will assume that there is no magnetization. And this is true because in most cases, because at high frequencies, such as a frequency of light, magnetic response simply negligible because it's too slow. It cannot follow such fast changes in the field. Magnetism is essentially slow thing. Therefore, all this magnetic recording information is very, very slow. In the end of this course, I will show that you can actually have optical magnetism, magnetism which oscillates at optical frequency, which is entirely new development. But for now, we assume that no magnetization and B is equal mu naught H. Mu naught is another funny thing, permeability of free space. Okay, how people did come to this equation, the divergence D is equal to rho? It's from the experiment. What people noticed at that time, the charges of the same sign repel, whereas charges of different signs attract each other. And so you can take into account this fact by introducing the electrical field and force through this formula. Then you can see that the force depends on the sign of the charge. You change the sign of the charge, the direction of force will be changed. Therefore, that actually breeds to this idea of the electrical field, which relates to the related to the force through this simple equation. So that's another thing. Of course, it was noticed that the force depends on the distance from a charge is 1 over r squared. And as we will see, that's exactly actually related to this equation. Another thing, just to remind you, so this is a convention. The electrical field starts at positive charges, and that's at the negative charges. And the density of these lines, electrical field lines, indicates how strong is the field. So, and that's all related, that larger charges give rise to stronger forces between charges, and Coulomb explained this with a stronger field, and you can picture this by placing more field lines. All right, let me remind you some mathematics to explain this first Maxwell's equation. This is a very general Gauss theorem, which tells you if you have the divergence of some vector field F, and if you integrate it over the volume, then that integral can be replaced by the surface integral, which is given by dot product of F and vector representing that surface, and that surface bounds the volume, binds the volume. Okay, so the surface which surrounds the volume, if you take the surface integral, it is exactly equal to this integral. This is famous Gauss theorem. Why it's relevant to our consideration? Because if you take this original equation, the divergence D is equal rho, and integrate both parts of the equation over the volume, then you apply this Gauss theorem, then this integral can be replaced by this one. Okay? As a result, you can write down this this first Maxwell's equation in this form. Here I use the fact that the displacement current is equals epsilon E. So, and according to this law, it's equal the total charge. If you integrate the charge density over the volume, you get the total charge. And then if you take, let's say, a single charge and integrate it over sphere, you immediately get the Coulomb's law, right? Because let's say if you take a sphere, if my charge is, wait, do we have a chalk? Okay, next time I guess I need to get some chalk. So you have a charge, okay, and you surrounded it by a sphere, integrate over sphere, then this integral would be E times 4πr squared, whereas here it would take the total charge. And that gives you the famous formula that the field is equal Q divided by 4πr squared and this epsilon. Okay, so what I'm saying that this immediately gives you the famous Coulomb's law. So in other words, this equation basically equivalent to the Coulomb's law. So the same thing with divergence of B. Since there are no charges, this integral is zero. Okay, this is very important, this couple Curl's equations, which represent Ampere's law and Faraday's law. Let's start from the Ampere's law. So circle of H is equal to the sum of the two terms, the current density J, that's just basically represent the Ohm's law, and the displacement current. This term, which usually ignored at low frequencies, turns out to play extremely important role in the optical range, because it's proportional to the frequency, actually, this term. And the larger the frequency, the stronger this term. And at optical, in the optical range, which we are focused on, this term actually plays a very, very important role and enables a number of things. So you can think of this situation when you have a current and a capacitance. And if the current is AC current, then you know that the current can go through the capacitance. So what happens here, so in this part, the curl of H related to the current density J, whereas here within the capacitance, actually the way the electromagnetic energy is transformed is through this displacement current. So if displacement current D, or that's why it's called the displacement current, because it works as a current, okay, or the flux density. So if it varies in time, then actually it allows to transfer electromagnetic energy. Well, and this is the law which was discovered by Ampere, the French scientist. And again, we could use the formula which is similar to the Gauss formula, because this, if you integrate curl H, the left and the right hand side of the equation over S, over the surface, then that integral curl H over the surface can be replaced by integral over the line binding that surface. And that's illustrated in the next slide. So that's again this general Stokes theorem, which tells if you have a circle of any vector function f integrated over the surface, that can be replaced by this dot product of that vector function f taken over the contour binding that surface. Okay, like for example, this would be surface, that would be the contour which binds the surface. So, and by using this, you can replace this integral with this one. And therefore, this original equation, the Ampere's law, in the differential form is equivalent to this equation in the integral form. And that's actually what represents the Ampere's law. Another curl equation, which represented the Faraday's law, again, we use the same trick. So let's integrate both sides of this equation over the surface and then replace this circle E with this contour integral. So then it can be written in this form. And this, as you remember, represents the electromotive force. So which it what it tells us that if you have the magnetic flux, because if you integrate B over the area, that gives you the magnetic flux. If you have the magnetic flux, which varies in time, that serves as a source of electromotive forces. So that induces a current in a closed loop. This is just the Faraday's law. So you just should, just reminding you that this differential equation is equivalent to this integral equation representing the Faraday's law. And this equation actually represents the Ampere's law. Well, this is the summary of Maxwell's equation. Again, this is just the Coulomb's law. And to go from this equation to the familiar to us Coulomb's law, you just use the Gauss theorem. You integrate over the volume both parts and then replace this integral over the volume with integral over S. And that immediately gives you the Coulomb's law. This basically tells there are no magnetic charges. The Faraday's law, the electromotive forces is equal to the derivative of the magnetic flux in the integral form, and this is the Ampere's law, which tells that the circle of H is equal to this sum of the two terms. Please pay attention that in this form we don't have all these parameters here. They're all hidden in B, D, and B and D basically describe the properties of material that take into account that material is polarized when you apply the field. So, but it's very nice form and there are no any parameters here. Well, it's the most important, perhaps, conclusion which follows from the Maxwell's equation right away. It's the existence of waves. And the thing to appreciate here that the waves can exist without charges. To have electromagnetic waves, you don't need a charge. And it's actually pretty easy to understand because if you come back to this, you can see that if you have a magnetic field varying in time, let's say that B is equal to mu naught H. If H varies in time, it gives you E. And if you look at this equation, if there are no even charges, if E varies in time, because even there are no any polarization, let's say we have free space vacuum, then this is just dE over dt, and this is dH over dt. You can see that if H varies in time, it gives you the field, electrical field. And the same way, if the electrical field varies in time, it gives you the magnetic field. So in the course of their propagation, if these two fields vary in time, they create another component. So that's the way light propagates. It has like these two components, two hands, if you wish, electrical and magnetic component. And if they both vary in time, then the wave can propagate, even with no charges, even without any materials in vacuum. And that's a very, very important conclusion. So now what we're going to do, we want to derive this equation which describes waves. The general formula which describes waves is given by this expression. And the solution to this equation is given by this, has this form. So it's just wave which propagates with velocity v. So what we want to show that from Maxwell's equation, we can obtain equation like this, which is a general equation describing waves. Well, so that's the goal. If you obtain this equation, it means that electrical field satisfies the wave equation, and therefore such a wave can exist. And to derive it again, probably most of you already did do it in the past, but let me recapitulated for you. So this is the original equation, the Faraday's law. Okay. Now I use the fact that B is equal mu naught H because we consider the case when there is no magnetization. And let's use the Ampere's law. So we will play with these two equations. Step number one, we take the curl from both parts of this equation. Then in the left-hand side of the equation, you get this double curl. And in the right side of the equation, you would get curl of this term. These two operations, derivative with respect of time and the curl, could be interchanged. That's what I have done here. But now let's use for the curl of H the Ampere's law and substitute it here. So then what we will get, this is step number two, this double curl of E. And now for curl of H, I use this equation. That would give me, you see, I have already one derivative and here is another derivative. That would give me the second derivative of the electric flux with respect to time, and this term would give me the first derivative of the current density. So now if you recall, the D is equal epsilon naught E plus P. So these two terms can be split into these two ones. And you see, we already have a term looking like this. Okay, so this still doesn't look like this, but this term, exactly what we wanted to obtain. Plus the two other terms which describes a material response. If you're dealing with vacuum, then this both of these terms go to zero in vacuum. Okay, again, this is the goal. This is the way we are standing now. So the next step is we need to use this vector identity, which tells you that the double cross product, and by the way, with this operator's Nabla operator, you can deal in exactly the same way as you deal with conventional vectors. It's a vector operator, and it therefore follows the same rules as any vector. And this is just, if you have this double cross product, you can replace it by this two different dot products, as the same way as you just would deal with conventional vectors. So, and therefore this double cross product can be replaced by this. But now let's recall the fact that the divergence of D is equal to rho, but if you don't have free charges, then it's equal to zero. And divergence D can be replaced by epsilon E. So if epsilon does not vary much with distance, that becomes divergence E. So that brings us to the conclusion that for media with no charges, divergence E is equal to zero. Therefore, this double circle can be replaced by simply this term. And that brings us to this equation. And that's almost exactly what we wanted to, with the exception that these two terms describe the response of a material. However, again, if you don't have any polarization, if you don't have any charges which provide the current, then these two terms should be dropped out and you come back to the equation which we wanted to derive. All right? So in general, in order to solve this equation, we need to find polarization, the response to the electrical field, and to find the current as a response to the electrical field. So in other words, we need to use this Ohm's law that relates the current and the electrical field. At this point, we assume there are no current, no free charges. Therefore, we set J equals zero. This term goes away. As for polarization, it's linearly proportional to the electrical field if the field is not too large. And this chi is a very important characteristic. It's called the susceptibility. It tells you how strong is the response of your material to the applied electrical field. The larger the polarizability, stronger is response. Okay, we neglected this term because we said that there are no free charges. Okay, for example, we consider propagation in dielectric. In dielectric, there are no free charges, let's say like glass. And now we'll recall that this polarization can be replaced by epsilon naught chi e. So then you would get equation in this form, or you could rearrange it and write it in this form. You see, and now you have exactly the equation we wanted to obtain. So the only limitations, we assume there are no free charges. So we are considering dielectrics. Well, So then, finally, we replace this 1 plus chi by epsilon r, which r stands for relative. So this is so-called relative dielectric permittivity, and that what exactly describes material properties. It's extremely important characteristic. So then that's the equations we want to obtain. Let me just make a couple comments here. We assume that the sign of the polarization is directed along the electrical field, which is not always the case. It's the case only for isotropic media. For anisotropic media, polarization could look in a different direction as compared to the electrical field. And that is expressed by this fact. You see, if chi is a tensor in general, not a scalar, and therefore it could look, let's say you apply the electrical field in this direction, whereas the material is polarized in that direction, if it's anisotropic. So as of now, we assume it's not the case. We assume that our material is isotropic, such as glass. And also, in general, polarization is not linearly proportional to the electrical field, but it can also have all these nonlinear responses, which are described by nonlinear susceptibilities of the second order, the third order, and so on. And they are defined as the coefficients of proportionality to the field raised to the second, to the third power, and so on. Again, for now, we assume that these terms are small, and this is justified if the electrical field is relatively small, and we assume that polarization is simply proportional to the field, linearly depends on the field, and directed in the same direction. So these two assumptions which we used, and which good enough for many cases, although not for all, then you end up with this equation, which is the wave equation.
Can I ask you?
Yes, please.
But the polarization proportional that E squared, it's not a vector. What happens there?
That's a very good point. It's not a vector in this case, but the trick here that should be written in this form, not in this form. Okay, for isotropic media, exactly because it's not a vector, this term is identically equal zero. For isotropic medium, you're absolutely right. You cannot create, if your medium is isotropic, then this is a scalar. And if you have E squared, it's not a vector. Therefore, it cannot give you a vector polarization. Therefore, this term in isotropic media is identically equal to zero. However, if your medium is anisotropic, then this is a tensor. And this equation has to be replaced chi ijk, it's a tensor of the third rank, times ejek. And then you can create a polarization, a vector with the right polarization. So to answer your question, for isotropic media, this, or to be exact, for media with inversion symmetry, this term is exactly equal to zero. However, for anisotropic media, because this is a tensor, this term can exist. It's a good question. Thank you. Well, that's actually the subject of nonlinear optics. You're very welcome to take my class on nonlinear optics. We will discuss there all these type of things. Okay, so this is why we ended up with. So this is the nice wave equation. And actually, there are very important consequences here. Okay, let's compare this with the general expression for the wave equation. What we have here, 1 over v, v represents actually the speed with which your wave propagates. And by comparing these two equations, we see that the speed of electromagnetic wave in this case is equal to 1 over this product of these three characteristics. So the dielectric permittivity and magnetic permeability of vacuum times 1 over the relative permittivity, which describes all the properties of your material. So, and this gives you the square of the light, of the speed with which light propagates in the material. If your material is vacuum, then the relative permittivity is 1, okay, because everything is related to vacuum. And then the speed of light is simply 1 over this product of epsilon naught mu naught. So this dielectric permittivity and magnetic permeability actually give you the inverse of that gives you the square of the light speed in vacuum. And if you multiply these two characteristics, you would obtain the well-known magnitude of the speed of light in vacuum, which is approximately 3 times 10 to the 8 meter per second. Let's also introduce the refractive index, which plays such an important role in optics. By definition, the refractive index gives you the ratio by which the speed of light is less in the material as compared to vacuum. That's what is the refractive index. And it's exactly equal to the square root of the dielectric permittivity, or to be exact, the relative dielectric permittivity, which in turn, the way we define it is 1 plus chi. So the refractive index related to these parameters characterizing polarization properties of your material for these relations, n is square root of epsilon r, or what is the same, the square root of 1 plus chi, where chi again is the susceptibility. So the whole effect of this relative permittivity or refractive index is just it slightly changes the light, the speed with which light propagates in material. Instead of C naught, which is the light speed in vacuum, you get V, and V related to C naught is just through the refractive index. Well, here I'm giving you the refractive index of different materials, and one of the reasons why silicon electronics is so important is here. The refractive index is very large. It also allows to concentrate, to confine light in silicon structures more efficiently than in others. The reason for that is I told you that with conventional dielectrics, you normally cannot confine light to a size smaller than the wavelengths. But the wavelengths in silicon would be lambda over n, and n is pretty large here. So therefore, the effective wavelength becomes like smaller. Therefore, you can accomplish stronger confinement with silicon structures, but not nearly as strong as you can do with metals, as we will discuss later. So in terms of dielectrics, silicon stands out. It has the largest refractive index. But in metals, what plays the role of the refractive index could be orders of magnitude larger. Metals are kind of very special in that case. Well, simply because the dielectric permittivity of metals can be 1,000. In this case, it's 12 in metals, it can be 1,000. That's a huge difference. It's negative, though. It's not that trivial. It's negative, and as a result, there are many, many special features in metals. But at least in magnitude, it's by far bigger, and people take a full advantage of that. That's exactly why eventually you can focus light down to nanoscale, because epsilon is so huge. All right, next what we want to do, we take this expression which describes a wave. And remember, this is a solution of the wave equation, and you can easily convince yourself. If you take the second derivative of with respect to r, when you substitute it here, so you would still have this exponential term, and when you take this second derivative with respect of time, you would get omega squared and the same exponential term. The exponential terms will cancel out, and you will end up with this equation. You would have here k squared, coming from second derivative with respect of r, and here you would get omega squared coming from the second derivative with respect of t, and this prefactor, n over c squared. And this is called the dispersion relation because it relates the wave vector, which is a very important characteristic describing wave propagation, to the frequency. And all the material properties are sitting in this refractive index n. Remember, n depends on the relative permittivity and on the refractive index. So let's introduce very important characteristic, the group velocity, which is by definition d omega over dk, and the phase velocity. In other words, this is the velocity with which phase propagates, and that's simply omega over k. And if you recall now how that omega over k is just c over n, and how n is related to epsilon r and chi, you would end up with this expression for the phase velocity. So the phase velocity is actually, if you plot it omega as a function of k, the phase velocity is just this straight line, and the group velocity could be anything, actually. It depends on how omega depends on k. Okay, and that in turn depends on how refractive index depends on the frequency. So these two characteristics are very important for understanding the propagation of light. So and this is called the dispersion relation. It actually relates the wave vector to the frequency. And the dependence of wave vector on frequency can be quite complicated because the refractive index in general can depend on the frequency as well. So materials consist of atoms. Response of atoms to the electrical field depends on the frequency, particularly if you're close to the resonance, and all that sitting in the sky. So since chi depends on the frequency, epsilon r depends on the frequency, refractive index depends on the frequency. Therefore, this relation becomes complicated. It could be anything. All right, so this is the equations we obtained for the electrical field. And this is so monochromatic waves because we assume that they all oscillated at single frequency. For the magnetic field, these same equations can be obtained. And these two equations actually describe the variation with respect to time and space of the both components, E, H, and K. And the important thing here to appreciate that they form a right-handed system. So they are all perpendicular to each other and form a right-handed system. And the metamaterials which I mentioned, which have negative refractive index, turns out to form a left-handed system, which results in many, many unusual properties to be discussed later. So if you look at the pointing vector, which characterizes the propagation of intensity, and intensity is energy per unit time per unit area. So that's actually what we call the pointing vector, which is defined as the cross product of E and H. You can see that the pointing vector would look in the direction of K, of the wave vector. Again, that would be completely reversed if you go to materials with negative refractive index. And it's clear why, because K is proportional to N. If N changes its sign, then K would start looking in opposite direction, whereas the pointing vector still would look in the same direction. So the situation would be like the energy goes this way, whereas the phase goes in opposite way. It's like if you throw a stone in water and the ripples, instead of going outward, would go inward. So that's all very, very wild in materials with negative refractive index. All right, I guess the time is up. Let me stop here. Because we had this extensive introduction, we didn't come to conclusion. And we will conclude, this review of Maxwell's equation next time, and also summarize what we studied in this review of Maxwell's equation. So as we showed last time, the electrical field of electromagnetic wave satisfies this wave equation. And the solution for this wave equation, which follows, by the way, from the basic Maxwell's equation, from the two circle equations, the solution has this form. It basically represents propagating waves with frequency omega and wave vector k. And also what we pointed out last time, that these three basic vectors, E, H, and K, form a right-handed system, where E and H, again, represent the electrical and magnetic components of light, and K gives you the wave vector. And the wave vector for, let's say, normal media coincides in direction with the pointing vector. The pointing vector is defined as the cross product of these two components of light, E and H, and it gives the direction for propagation of energy, or to be more specific, intensity, which is the energy per unit time per unit area. So that's what we accomplished last time. Now the thing which we would like to discuss in more detail is how to relate material parameters to fields. How polarization, which is defined as for which we use this notation P, is related to the electrical field. And remember, the polarization, it's actually describing the response of a material. It represents a dipole moment per unit volume, and it tells us how much atoms are polarized in response to the applied electrical field. So this is the definition for polarization. It's related to the field E through this coefficient of proportionality chi, which we call susceptibility. And the larger the susceptibility, the stronger response of a material to the applied electrical field. It turns out that this particular expression that we used last time is true only under the assumption that the response is instantaneous. In other words, if you apply the field instantaneously, you get a response, which is never the case in real systems because there is always certain lag time. So that's actually true when material, to be more specific, has instantaneous response and doesn't have any losses. Because losses usually imply there is certain time which it takes for a material to respond to the applied field. In more general case, polarization related to the field through this integral relation, and it depends on the function x, which is called the response function. So you could say that polarization results from response to the field over some characteristic time tau. And the thing to appreciate here, that if you're looking for, let's say, for the field at time, at particular time t, it depends only on the past. It depends on behavior of your system in the previous time moments, but it cannot depend on the response function taken at the time from the future. So, which it mathematically what it means that that response function actually has to be identical zero for the times larger than the time at which we consider in the electrical field. So, and that actually represents the very fundamental principle which is called causality. So again, what physically it means that the response you have at any particular time instant can depend only on the past, but cannot depend on the future, because the system doesn't know anything what's going to happen in the future. All right, therefore, the response function always has this this type of behavior at the time larger than the time instant at which we consider in the field. It has to be identically zero. And that's, as I said, represent the causality principle. So this is the most general relation which relates the polarization and the electrical field. Whereas this is just a very special case. If you come back to this general definition and put here this Fourier representation for the electrical and polarization, then we end up in this with this expression. And this is actually exact expression. So it relates the Fourier component of polarization and the Fourier component of the electrical field. And then this is true susceptibility, which is a function of frequency. The thing to appreciate here, that the way we introduce susceptibility in this way as a coefficient of proportionality between polarization and E, it's true not for the polarization and field itself taken in the time domain, but rather for their Fourier components. So if you go from the time domain to the frequency domain, so in other words, if you take the Fourier, if you do the Fourier decomposition, then susceptibility gives you this relation. So this is the very fundamental, this is true, and we think here that susceptibility indeed does depend on the frequency. Okay, so this relation, again, it's true for the amplitudes of the polarization and the field, but not for the field and polarization themselves. Okay, so the relation has to be taken in the in the frequency domain. Well, and now let's recall this relation which we already considered in between epsilon and chi, but now we specifically indicate that those both functions are functions of the frequency. So again, let me just sum up what I just said. This expression is not general. It's true only if we assume that system responds to the applied field instantaneously, which always implies that there are no losses. And it's never exactly the case. It could be approximately true, but never exactly the case. Okay, whereas this expression, when you write it in the for Fourier components, is the exact one. And by the way, this chi, I forgot to place it here on this slide, is related to x as simply as the Fourier decomposition. Chi is a Fourier integral of this response function. All right, so a little bit more formulas. Again, let's write down this electromagnetic wave in this form, as we always do. So this is the dispersion relation, which we considered last time. And that relation connects, links the frequency and the wave vector. And that's the formula for the wave vector, which is related to the refractive index through this simple formula. If you have a material which has a... Yes?
I saw that equation even earlier where you write that the first line, you have this E dependent on Z
right
on the right side. Is it actually K or actually Z? Is it a typo? The right-hand side, the other side. Yeah.
Oh, here it should be K.
Okay.
I'm sorry, yeah. It should be K here. Well, it strictly speaking, well, that's also true. It depends on K, but it depends on Z as well. Because if you have not a monochromatic wave, so that in principle the amplitude, so this gives you the conventional sinusoidal type of dependence, but the amplitude could have envelope type of dependence on Z to describe a pulse. So this is actually also true. In principle, the amplitude, if it's not a plane wave, then the amplitude also can depend on the distance, as well as on time as well. Okay. However, if you do really the Fourier decomposition, and that's what is written here, then the right way to place here is K. Here, what was implied in this formula, it's K, not Z. So I apologize for this. All right, the thing which I'd like to draw your attention to now is the fact that if you have absorption, then the refractive index is never a real number. It has also an imaginary number, imaginary part, and the imaginary part describes absorption. So let's now specify what we mean by this. So let's write down the refractive index in this form as the real part plus I, the imaginary part. And again, I know that in the engineering we use J, so I'm kind of more used to this I. That's what physicists prefer to use. And remember that I and J is actually not the same thing. I is equal minus J, so don't confuse these two things. Okay, so that's the way we will write refractive index. And now if you come back to this definition and substitute this expression for N, then you would get K in this form. And let's isolate the real part and the imaginary part of that. The real part, which we call beta, it actually represents the wave number. It actually characterizes the special variance when the wave propagates in the medium. So the inverse of beta would give you the wavelengths, actually. And alpha represents the absorption coefficient. Why I put here alpha over 2? Because if you come to intensity, if you square the electrical field, then it will become alpha. And the absorption coefficient, which is alpha, defined for the intensity rather than for the field. Okay, therefore, for the field, we have alpha over 2. But when you square the field to consider intensity, then you would get this alpha. Okay, and that's the absorption coefficient. So again, if you write down the field in this form, so we have this term which describes harmonic dependence on time. We have this traveling wave special dependence, and we have this decay. So the thing to remember from here is that beta is related to the real part of refractive indexes omega over c n prime, and it could be written as k naught n prime. And k naught now is a real number, and that's, if you wish, what we call, let's say, wave vector when we speak of the special variation of a wave. And alpha, the absorption coefficient, is 2 times omega over c minus n double prime, where n double prime is the imaginary part, which also can be written as minus 2 k naught n double prime, and that's the absorption coefficient. So let's also mention that the susceptibility is indeed also has the imaginary part, and that imaginary part would be also related to losses in the system. If you now recall that the refractive index related to the susceptibility through this general formula, it's simply square root of 1 plus chi. And if you write down chi as the sum of the real and imaginary part, as it's written here, so then also let's recall that n in terms, as we just saw, is n prime minus the imaginary part, which can be written as I alpha over 2k naught. So then we can make this equation. If we assume that chi is relatively small, which implies that we are dealing with a material which has low density of atoms. So if chi is small, then this square root can be approximated in this form. And then if you replace this square root by this expression, you can immediately obtain this simple formula for the refractive index. When we say refractive index, in this case, we imply the real part. Although we shouldn't confuse, there is, let's say, complex refractive index, which also has this imaginary part describing absorption. In this case, I mean the real part of the refractive index. And the absorption coefficient then related to chi 2. You see, it's very simple. Chi prime defines the refractive index, whereas chi double prime defines the absorption. But keep in mind, these simple formulas are not always true. They are true only in the case when the susceptibility is relatively small. Normally, it's true only for guesses. In more generic case, the real and imaginary part of refractive index related to chi through this formula. All right, that's basically this point. We would like to summarize what we considered during the first lecture, although the first lecture kind of was dragged out into the second one. But here is the summary, what we considered so far. This is four basic Maxwell's equations, which describe the whole electrodynamics we're going to consider within this course. So the first equation basically is equivalent to the Coulomb's law. And remember, it could be obtained right away if you just integrate both parts of this equation over volume and then use the Gauss theorem. So then this the volume integral can be replaced by the surface integral, which would immediately give you eventually the Coulomb's law. The equation which says the divergence of B, magnetic flux, is equal to zero basically says to us that there are no magnetic charges. And these two circle equations are extremely important, and by playing with these two equations, we actually obtain the wave equation, which describes propagation of electromagnetic waves in space. And as we saw, that waves can exist even without any charges. They can propagate without any charges. The thing to appreciate here, we can see that the time-varying magnetic field results in the electrical field, and the time-varying electrical field, which is sitting here, results to the magnetic field. And that's the way, actually, electromagnetic wave propagates in space. So that's the wave equation I was talking about. If we're considering a propagation of a wave in the material, then we have to take into account this polarization. We assume here that there are no free charges. All charges are bound, so therefore only polarization is occurring. We have only polarization contributing to the wave equation. And polarization is simply the dipole moment per unit volume. It shows how much the negative charge is displaced with respect to its equilibrium position as a result of the applied field. So this is the fundamental equation which relates the polarization, the response of your material, to the electrical field. Okay, and the coefficient of proportionality is the susceptibility. Remember that this equation is true in the frequency domain. In other words, P and E here are the Fourier components of the polarization and the electrical field. And only if the response can be approximated as instantaneous, the same equation turns out to be true also in the time domain. So this wave equation can be rewritten because P is proportional to E, in this form, where n is the refractive index. So, and we already discussed how refractive index is related to chi. Finally, we also use this equation relating the polarization in the electrical field. This is called response function. And when you write the same equation in the frequency domain, we get this expression, chi related to x through the Fourier integral. Okay, I just simply forgot to write this. So that's very, very important basic equations by using which we can describe all the spectacular phenomena related to optics in general and nonphotonics specifically. All right, that's what we're going to consider next. So we will consider this chi, how we derive chi by using simple model of harmonic oscillator describing atomic system of atoms in materials. And we also characterize basic classes of materials, insulators or dielectrics, semiconductors, and metals. All right, this is basically just summary for your convenience of formulas which we used. So that's, again, the Maxwell's equations, the way displacement is related to displacement current is related to the electrical field, relative permittivity, very important, it's 1 plus chi, how B is related to H, the Gauss theorem, okay, and the Stokes theorem, actually, which reminds us how we can by using these two curl equations, how we can derive, first can go to the integral equation, to the integral form. This just represents the Ampere's law, and we in the equation which follows from here represent the Faraday's law. All right, this is just a little bit reminding how we obtain this wave equation by playing with this double curl. Yes?
Just to check my understanding, on the dynamic relation between P and E, should the limits on the integral just be from negative infinity to T for causality?
No, you can put from minus infinity to plus infinity, but because chi is identically zero for t larger than t prime, it's the same. Because we define chi in such a way that it's identically zero. Therefore, here you do have it from minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay, any other questions? So that's kind of summary and useful formulas.